from St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. There has been a lot of ink spilled about how the 2024 election is prompting waves of anxiety across the country. Some of that may be linked to our impossible desire for clarity and certainty about our tumultuous times. Another factor could be how we consume political information. Yes, it's fair to say that candidates have always tried to stretch the truth in advertisements or on the stump, but the decline of traditional media sources and the rise of social media created an environment where clearly false information about elections and candidates can spread like wildfire. St. Louis Public Radio's Abby Larico recently spoke about the 2024 electoral discourse with the Media Education Lab's Natasha Casey, who is also a media literacy educator at Lincoln Land Community College in Springfield, Illinois.
Now that we are living in a world where even public figures, these official sources, are willingly sharing misinformation, disinformation, AI, I imagine your job has evolved quite a bit.
I would say you're right. There was, you know, a point in time where media literacy maybe to its detriment focused almost exclusively on this kind of fact-checking. I used to spend a lot of time in class with students just looking at articles and dissecting them line by line and going through them. And I think, you know, for a long time, that's how we thought about news literacy. In recent years, I've started to think a lot more, and media literacy has done this too. The National Association for Media Literacy Education, for example, now has a little component about understanding how emotion works in terms of receiving information. Because when you look at political messages, they're all running on emotion, right? Whether it's the voiceovers, whether it's the music used, whether it's the, you know, the kinds of snippets of conversations or things taken out of context. And for me, this has become a bigger part, you know, and media literacy can help people skillfully become more aware of those kinds of things. But yeah, it's a challenge because we live in an age of absolute information overload, don't we?
I also think that there might be some evolution perhaps in don't believe everything you see. Mm-hmm. Now you also are dealing with people not believing what they do see or hear, and that emotional feeling of something is true or isn't true is really hard to overcome with this. So does that kind of change what baseline truth even is for someone, because people live in their truth, right?
And this is the problem with using the internet, of course, and I think people don't understand a lot of times how the internet functions, and that what they're seeing and what I'm seeing when we do a Google search, and I do a Google search, Abby, you know, we're getting two different sets of results, you know, depending on what Wi-Fi we're connected in to, and also depending on our past history. And I think, you know, people's failure to understand that is another reason why media literacy is really important. Just understanding that what they often call the architecture of the internet, you know, how the internet functions and how it creates these filter bubbles for us. And I think that's a baseline for students to understand, well, for all of us, frankly, to understand that our information is being tailored to us based on what we have entered into the machine before. You know, I think it was Pew Research did some work on this a while ago that a large percentage of Americans don't trust mainstream media anymore. And there's lots of complicated reasons why that is the case. But the younger you are, the less likely you are to trust so-called mainstream media. And that's also terrifying, because when I ask students how they know what they know, right, which is the first kind of basic question of media literacy, how do you know what you know about the world? They're not able to answer that question. But I'm not sure many of us can answer that question in this age either.
So talking about some of these institutions that have traditionally existed in more traditional formats, you have the FTC. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, has something that's called truth in advertising laws. These are supposed to prevent companies from making false claims about their products and ads. But those rules don't apply to political ads. The Supreme Court has ruled those as protected political free speech. They only really have to disclose who's paying for the ad. Do you think people really know what can and can't be said, really?
I think the average person is unlikely to know that broadcast television stations, right, are prohibited from censoring or rejecting political ads that are paid for and sponsored by legally qualified candidates.
Do you think an understanding of what these rules are that certain forms of media have to abide by or don't have to abide by has an impact on how people process that information?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you're able to understand, like you said, how these processes work, how these laws work, I think people would have a better understanding. Although I have seen a lot of television news stories in this last year that sort of pull back the curtain a little bit, as it were, on this topic and start to explain these laws to its viewers who are, you know, confused and outraged by you're watching local news on the one hand, and then it goes to commercial break and you're seeing these types of political advertisements.
Talking more about the rules specifically, in television ads, on print adverts or mailers, for example, they aren't legally required to do the thing where they have small print citing the sources, but they're often intended to be a cover for the source making the claim. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways creates an illusion of trustworthiness. It seems like they're citing your sources, so I believe it.
Right.
What are some other things that campaign political messaging, what are some of the other ways in which they try to convey a sense of trustworthiness?
I don't know that they do. To be honest with you, I'm not exactly sure that they do, because I think these kinds of political dirty tricks have been going on for so long that this is my own, you know, my own approach to it. On the one hand, these adverts must have some impact, right? It's a billion-dollar industry in the political cycle. But on the other hand, it's hard to imagine that people really take these adverts seriously. These kinds of political dirty tricks and commercials, of course, have been going on for years. This is nothing new. Just the technology maybe that is spreading them is a little bit different. And it's also faster circulating, of course, with the internet. But you can look at political science papers over the years, and some would argue that they have little to no effect, and then others would say that they do. But it's still, why are political parties and their affiliates spending billions of dollars on these commercials if there's no effect at all? So, but at the same time, it's hard, really, when you watch some of these adverts to think, is somebody really taking this, you know, verbatim? Is somebody really believing these messages?
I've seen ones where, for example, this is clearly sound bites taken out of context,
right,
and it's clearly mashed up. And so, okay, the average citizen sees an advertisement like that and says, I don't buy that. Like you're saying, maybe it isn't necessarily trustworthy on its own face. But if that's part of a larger myth-making media ecosystem in which similar storylines are continuously repeated, do you think that just the sheer volume of even half-truths ultimately add up to being able to create a certain picture about a candidate or an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, that is a possibility. But I think a more likely scenario comes out of something that I read fairly recently. There was a study in this past summer in the American Journal of Sociology, and it showed that voters, and this is voters from the two main political parties, so not just one side or the other, it shows that voters provide moral justification for politicians' statements, even when they know their preferred politician is lying. And they call this factual flexibility, which is a lovely oxymoronic term. But the same study used this other term called moral flexibility, whereby voters justify fact flouting as an effective way of proclaiming a deeply resonant truth. You know, and that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Because J.D. Vance just did this pretty recently when he admitted the pet and the immigrant story.
The story about the Haitian migrants. He said, if I need to come up with stories like this so the media pays attention to the larger issue, that's what I'll do.
Yes. And this is what this study suggested, that so even when people know the politicians are lying, they're okay with it. And if you think about this, this kind of makes sense from a psychological point of view, right? Because, I mean, in our own personal lives, don't we have people who lie to us? Might we tell the odd half-truth every once in a while? Abby, come on.
Fables are as old as time.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, in the larger picture, if you're saying to yourself, you know, this candidate is supporting what I want, ultimately, it's justifiable. So I think that's a more interesting way to think about it, rather than just thinking about, is somebody convinced by this political ad, you know?
Mm-hmm. The image of the little girl holding a puppy in the aftermath of the hurricane in North Carolina, and it is clearly, for the mildly to moderately trained eye, AI.
Yeah.
And you have party officials sharing this image and then being called out on it and said, being told this is AI,
right,
and then coming out and saying, it doesn't matter, it's still seared in my brain because this is indicative of what the greater issue is.
Yeah.
It's creating a new level on the fact checkometer, if you will.
It is, and no average person, let alone journalists and researchers and educators, right, can quote unquote fact check every single thing. But that's what I find interesting about that study is, like, even if you did fact check, that a lot of people are willing to override the fact that it's a half truth, a partial truth, that it's AI. I mean, AI is going to complicate, is complicating this media landscape in ways that we could have never expected. And I think this is one of the reasons that you're seeing this sort of erosion of trust and authority. This didn't start with the AI, it didn't start with the internet, and it goes back years. You think about politicians refusing to answer questions directly, you know, spinning their message, right? They've been doing that for years, and they continue to do that. And so I think people are fed up with a lot of that, and so it's easier to just say, you know, sort of write off all the politicians together and say, you know, you're all sort of spinning, rather than do the work that's necessary.
The FTC has a specific role, which is protecting the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is treating the person who is ultimately going to vote based on what they're learning in these advertisements as a consumer, not as a citizen.
Right.
How does their purpose really impact the product of what they are allowing to hit the airwaves?
Yeah, I think when you look at that FTC's mission, right, it is to protect the public from deceptive or unfair business practices. And but political ads, as we've just pointed out, particularly those on television and radio, sort of slip between those cracks. And they're really not covered, as the First Amendment is that sort of out, or that excuse, if you like, for almost everything. But when we think about the FTC and the things that it has done to protect consumers over the years, right, there's some famous cases where it protects consumers from false advertising, right? Those are all great things that it does. But can we say that political advertising is akin to, you know, fast food products or, you know, car commercials, right? I mean, this is very different, I think, right, especially in a political season during the election. So, for example, the FTC in 2014 fined Red Bull, right? Red Bull, it turns out, doesn't give you wings. Okay, that's great. And that's great for the consumers. But when we see these kind of outright falsehoods, lies, manipulation in political adverts, surely that has to be handled a little bit differently.
Broadcast outlets are required to offer equal coverage, but companies like Meta, X, TikTok, they can make their own decisions on this. Mm-hmm. In this election cycle, we've seen a graphic commercial from a third-party presidential candidate featuring what are apparently images of aborted fetuses that some local television stations have to air because mm-hmm. of FCC laws.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen a Republican primary candidate ultimately getting banned from Instagram because of her aggressively anti-LGBTQ speech. Those examples show just how different the rules can be over different types of platforms. How does the context around a message, maybe where it's heard, impact our understanding of the message itself?
Yeah, I think I mean that one of the challenges with this is political advertising online is not regulated at all in the same ways. I mean, regulated in sort of inverted commas, quotation marks, really, because the regulations are pretty loose, even in television and radio. But in those online spaces, I think we can't even understand the impact that they're having. They're able to micro-target audiences in a way that television and radio are not. They're seeping into all of our social media, whatever platform you're on. So I think it's hard to assess the impact that those are having in those online spaces. And then especially when you have, when you look at X, okay, somebody's banned on Instagram, but then they still have their, you know, their X, formerly Twitter account, up and running and are able to, just shows the problems with private companies, owning these outlets, and that they're really marching to their own drumbeat, right? They have their own rules as far as this stuff goes.
And that has an impact on the discourse. When somebody gets taken off of Meta because of their quote-unquote anti-woke views, for example, even though a private company has the rights to enforce its terms of use, that's seen as censorship. These days, what role does perceived censorship play in a consumer's understanding of media messaging?
Yeah, I think this goes back, though, to questions of the erosion of authority and trust. And so when people say they're being censored, it's because of distrust of mainstream media. And like I said earlier, it's now about Gallup poll data suggested that only about a third of U.S. adults say they have a great deal of trust in media. And so I think that leaks over, into these online spaces where you can capitalize, I think, on this, what's become a bit of a norm in society, that you don't trust mainstream media, especially not news media, So...
just the idea that for some people, if you're conditioned to believe the mainstream media is untrustworthy, and then the mainstream media is not just NBC and CBS, but also Facebook, and they're censoring something, mm-hmm. do you think there's almost a reflex to say, well, this just proves my point that the mainstream media doesn't want us talking about these certain things or doesn't want my candidate talking about certain things?
Yeah, I think it does feed into it. I mean, it's clearly a myth. I mean, the U.S. has some of the least restrictions and regulations on speech and certainly political speech at anywhere on the planet. Things that are said here... wouldn't fly in most other so-called Western democracies around the world. But at the same time, I think, I don't really believe that Elon Musk thinks he's being censored, right? But I think what he's doing is tapping into that suspicion in mainstream media, right? And I think that's the difference, is that... that resonates with a lot of people. And I think in part it's because mainstream media up until probably very recently has not done a very good job of sharing how the news sausage is made with the people. And I think over the last 10 years you see more outlets sort of pulling back the curtain a little bit and helping to explain to citizens, right, that there are certain things, there are deadlines, there are geographical restraints, there are, sources that you use, and being a little bit more open about it. But I think when news media didn't do that for a long time, and then there were some massive high-profile cases of the media getting it wrong, right, the Iraq war being the one in the New York Times, of course, supporting that, I think it does. It's created this legacy that accounts for why so many Americans do not believe mainstream news anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Politicians could theoretically sue one another for defamatory comments. Maybe they'll win, maybe they won't. They could take it to court. But there's something that could exist maybe there. For the people within these advertisements
and speeches and interviews,
and I'm talking about the vilified illegal aliens, that's the term that's used so much in political messaging this year, murderous abortion providers to describe certain doctors, or even, frankly, people whose personal stories are co-opted to reinforce a political storyline about a candidate's opponent, for example. We've seen people become characters in these political fights. But what recourse do they have?
Yeah, not much. I mean, you could. And there's been a couple of cases. There's a recent case in up in Oregon of one politician suing another. I think they're running against each other again, but they're suing each other for defamation, you know, from the last election. But I think what ends up happening then is just you just give more oxygen to the aspects of the case that you don't want to give oxygen to is number one. And then two, it's like, who can afford to bring a case anyway against what are these enormous, you know, PACs or other groups that are producing these messages in the first place? So there isn't much recourse, sadly, you know, but that's just a reality of where we're at.
Today's episode was produced by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.